So happy it's Thursday. Welcome. ESPN 1700 AM is the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. Still getting a little bit situated here in the studio. There's five of us crammed in here. Hi, Brenda. Welcome.
Nothing like cutting it right down to the wire, right?
Right down to the wire. Hi there, Brenda.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us. That's Brenda Geiger. Thank you very much for being with us as well. Miles Hubers.
Morning, afternoon, I guess.
And also,
morning to you, right?
Yeah.
Supervising this whole operation, we have Kathleen Valbuena. She's a real estate agent here with RE/MAX, supervising everything that goes on. Brenda Geiger is an estate and trust attorney. She is with, I have it right here, Geiger Wealth Management. Your website here, what's her website?
Geiger Law. Law.
That's it, geigerlaw.net. If I have that right?
Office.
GeigerLawOffice.net. Perfect. Also, Miles Hubers is a mortgage banker for nearly 30 years.
28.
Oh, that's nearly
it's round
30.
Up, right?
Round up. Okay, perfect.
But, yeah.
And he's going to talk to us about the no-doc loan, right?
No-doc
loan.
Yep.
As well as our HARP loan. And you just mentioned to me, HARP loan, 200% upside down, and can do a HARP loan with no income verification?
Yeah, if you're current on your mortgage, you can do a primary and your income property. As long as you're current on your mortgage, there is no income documentation.
Wow.
If you're self-employed. If you're self-employed.
So what is today's rate? I mean, forget the HARP, forget the no doc. Traditional 417 loan amount, conventional loan. What is today's rate?
It always depends on your credit score or your FICO and how much equity you have, your loan to value. 3.5% is 0 points if you have a good credit score and 20% equity.
3.5%.
3.5.
No points.
Up a little bit because the market's gotten better.
30-year fixed on that one?
30-year fixed.
Wow. So if I have a rate above what amount do I need to start talking about refinancing?
If you're above 4%, you should definitely take a look at analyzing your mortgage payment to see if you can save money at no cost, because you could do a no-point, no-cost loan because we get rebates in order to pay for all the closing costs. So anything above 4%.
4%, they need to call.
Yeah.
The helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593.
I got to say, you know, the sign of the lenders being unreasonable for a while with regards to their underwriting guidelines. I mean, some might say it was necessary based on the fact that the market was in a catastrophic situation. But now I find that we're reinventing ourselves, right? I mean, the marketplace is appreciating in value. Banks are starting to be more lenient with their underwriting guidelines. I mean, this sounds really flexible to be able to underwrite a loan and what, not have income verification?
Well, these are people that are current on their payment with the HARP program. The HARP is Home Affordability Refinance Program. The new loans, you know, what got us in trouble was the stated income loan, where a person would just state their income with no money down and no recourse. So when the property values drop, people just walk from their homes. So today's new purchase programs with no tax returns require a 720 FICO and 30% equity. So, you know, the guidelines have gotten stricter and more conservative, and especially now that the market's appreciating.
Well, it's really nice to see that, because I think what you're saying is that people are finally being rewarded for making their payments.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, for a while, everybody used to say in order to get a loan modification or in order to get a short sale, you needed to stop making your mortgage payment, which is obviously a pretty easy thing to do. But a lot of people out there felt committed to the agreement that they had made with the bank to continue making their payments no matter what was going on in the economy. And now what you're saying is with this new HARP program, they're able to refinance and they don't actually have to show the income that was that would be the underwriting guideline that would be necessary for what, a 32% debt-to-income ratio?
It's usually up to 43, 44% debt-to-income. But if you're self-employed, they go by your gross income if you're current on your mortgage. Does that make sense, or is that confusing? You had a puzzled look.
No, I mean, I makes sense.
You can't see it on the radio,
you
right?
Dumb it down. You got to dumb it down for me, Kelvin.
Oh, thanks, Ryan. Thanks,
but, you know, it makes sense. You know, a lot of these people in 2008 and 2009, they're at 6.5% and 7%. So if they're making their payment at 6.5% or 7%, they've been current, they're certainly going to make it at 3.5% or 4%.
Right, so it's a make-sense deal.
It is.
Well, regarding make-sense, I mean, a lot of people out there have variable rates right now. And it may make sense to keep that variable rate where it is because it's actually lower in terms of payments than a fixed rate. Would you say – I mean, obviously we can't hold you to this. Would you say based on the fact that you're on the front lines of what's going on out there in the mortgage industry that it would be a good time to lock that loan into a fixed rate, or you think it's maybe something they should keep risking?
Well, I think that really depends on how long you're going to own the home. Obviously, we're at a record low in interest rates. So if you can lock into 3.25 and 3.5 and you're going to own the home for a long time, I think, you know, locking at the bottom would be a great idea. If you're only going to own the home for 3 more years, then maybe a 3-year fix is adequate. So you do pay a higher rate for a longer term. So let's say you know your son or daughter is going to college in 3 years and you're in a big house and you're going to downsize or right size. Maybe a 30-year fix doesn't make sense. So it really depends on how long you plan to own the home.
Now, we're noticing a lot of people out there right now are refinancing. I mean, most of us here probably did a refinance recently based on the low interest rates. With that, a lot of people are taking their properties out of a trust. And we're finding more often than not, they're not. Is that true, Brenda? I mean, you're a trust attorney. Are you seeing people contact you to say, I'm changing my trust, I need some advice here? Or are you finding – what are you finding out there?
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is people that have their house in trust title, when they go through the refi process, it's very common for most lenders to take it out of trust title and just put it individually in their names as joint tenants or as community property with right of survivorship. But what's not happening sometimes is escrow is not putting it back into the trust. If they don't have instructions to do so, they may not do it. So then they're kind of left with a gap in their coverage, so to speak, because if they die and it's outside the trust, it's going to go through the probate process.
What does that mean to have a property in a trust, and why do I want it that way or not want it that way?
Well, in California, we do not have pay-on-death designees on our deeds. So what that means is that in order to pass that asset, let's say, to children, it's got to go through a vehicle like a trust. So the most common that we see for personal residence is to put it into a revocable trust. So that's something that the person who creates the trust can update and amend. They can modify or revoke. They can do whatever they want with it in the future as long as they have capacity to do so.
So mm-hmm. Trust is a way of telling the state what to do with your assets once you pass away.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and it also helps people during incapacity too. People think of trusts and wills as just being a vehicle to pass assets at death, but it's also a way to manage your property in the event that you know, you become incapacitated. Your family members or other trusted advisors can step in and take charge as trustee.
So is it safe to say everybody should have a trust?
Yeah, I think pretty much. I mean, the only caveat to that is if you had a young adult who's just in college, I'd say at least have incapacity documents such as an advanced health care directive, power of attorney, and a HIPAA authorization so that your parents or other people that you select can make decisions for you if you get in an accident or something. But generally speaking, yes.
And do you find that everybody has a trust, or is that fairly uncommon?
No, I think the national statistic is somewhere between 20% and 30% of Americans. It's probably a little higher in California because of the way that our laws are set up and because probate is such a horrendous process to go through. It usually takes about 12 to 24 months. It costs about 5 times more than a trust administration, and it's open to public inspection so everybody can see what you owned and who you left it to.
So why doesn't everybody have one?
You know, I think it's largely lack of education, lack of taking the time, if you do know about it, to do it.
Oh, okay. Good enough. So I think it is your recommendation that, especially if you own real property, you should have a trust.
Yeah. In fact, when I was 19 years old, I was living at home with my dad. I had just started college, and he was diagnosed with stage 4 terminal colon cancer. And he died within 2 months, and he did have a trust. And it really did help our family avoid that heartbreak of having to go through the probate process, and we were able to privately administer his estate. He was an antique dealer, and he had a bunch of antiques in storage and in the garage. And actually, that's how I made my living when I was in college, you know, paying
really?
paying for all the little things, you know, minus the tuition. I had to get loans for that, but, you know, it was a godsend that we had that set up.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, you've come an awful long way. I mean, you've written a number of books. In fact, you're on the third edition of Why, right? I mean, the Safeguarding Your Nest.
Safeguard the Nest, yeah.
And you've got a new book out right now?
Yeah, the new book is How to Avoid the Catastrophic Costs and Effects of Long-Term Care. It's a California Elder Law Guide. My other book is an estate planning guide. But the two kind of cross over in some respects because they both involve trusts.
We're on with Brenda Geiger. Her website, geigerlawoffice.net. I'm going to spell that. G-E-I-G-E-R, lawoffice.net. She's discussing the necessity for a trust and also discussing, well, some of the books that she's written. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about this new product, No Ratio Loans. And we've got a whole laundry list of questions about for you, Brenda, about wills and trusts ahead of us when we come back.
Welcome back to ESPN 1700, the Real Estate Radio Hour, with your host, Ryan White, and myself, David McKelvin. We are on the line with estate and wealth advisor Brenda Geiger. Brenda Geiger, your why, I mean, the whole story about your father is very shocking with the situation that you had, you know, come from with that, and you worked your way through college, now author of multiple books, the third edition on your primary book, and you've got a symposium coming up because you're actually going to be speaking to a lot of financial advisors. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the signature event that we have for our law firm every year is the Trust and Estate Symposium, and it's usually in May or June. This year it's May 30th, and it's going to be at the Museum of Music Making in Carlsbad on Armada Drive. So it's going to be
right above the flower fields over there.
Yeah, and it's got a nice ocean view. They're one of our sponsors, and they're also letting everybody that attends go through the museum afterwards, so it's kind of a nice little bonus. But this year, our topic is asset protection. So our first speaker is going to be talking about how do you asset protect retirement accounts for your beneficiaries. So, you know, that she's going to be primarily talking about retirement trust planning. A lot of people don't know what a retirement plan trust is. So she's going to be speaking on that. And our second speaker is going to be talking about asset protection for elders. So what that means is, how do we plan ahead for long-term care? So if we know we've got a limited amount of funds and there's a possibility that if a catastrophic event happened, how can we asset protect what we have or what our parents have so that they don't get wiped out in the event of something tragic happening and long-term care having an effect and an impact on their lives? And then I'm actually going to be speaking as well on how to asset protect what you leave behind for your children in lifetime continuing trusts, and also how to protect real estate in LLCs so that, you know, if somebody slips and falls on the property, you don't get wiped out and get sued personally. And our last speaker is going to be flying in from Nevada. He's going to be talking about domestic asset protection trusts.
Yeah, I mean, commonly you're speaking, and this is just one of the engagements that you have coming up. This is the May 30th event, the symposium. And, you know, we talked briefly about the fact that we're seeing a lot of the properties that are being refinanced not necessarily being put back into the trust. In fact, I had a conversation with the seller about that today, because more often than not, we are seeing homeowners have trusts and they've got their property set up that way. If you don't have it set up that way, it's almost like you're really missing the boat, because you're just leaving yourself, in a lot of cases, out in for liability. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, if you run into a problem, you become incapacitated and you don't have a power of attorney, or you don't have a proper power of attorney, I should say, you know, you may not even be able to get it back into the trust. So if you later passed away, then that would be forced through probate. But yeah, and I see this all the time. People come in for me to restate their trust that somebody else has drafted for them years ago, and then we discover when we pull title, uh-oh, this thing's not in trust title. And I also commonly see married couples that have their real estate in joint tenancy. I think that's kind of a default when they purchase. It just automatically, when
probably
it goes through escrow, I don't think, you know, and I know title's not supposed to counsel them, give them any legal advice, so it's just kind of a common way that I see things done. But if the couple really intends this to be a community property asset, it's that they want to own it together, it under our laws, for federal capital gains reasons, you know, we may want to have that community property before it hits the trust, so that we've got a title, you know, a chain of title, so that if there is ever an audit at the death of the first spouse, we get a double step up in basis. And basically what that means is, I'll explain it. If you had purchased a house for $100,000, and let's say you're married and you bought it you know, together. You bought it in joint tenancy. 30 years goes by. The first spouse passes away. That spouse that's surviving now has, let's say now the property's worth $1 million. They now have a $550,000 new basis because the deceased spouse's half stepped up half. So $500,000, and the surviving spouse still has their original $50,000. They're half of the basis. So now the new basis is $550,000. So you can see there's a $450,000 gain. And, you know, capital gains rates just went up in January. So now let's redo this. Let's say they took it in community property. You know, 30 years has gone by. We've got that tracing that it's in community property on the deed. You know, it's in the trust. Now, when the surviving spouse goes to sell that property, it's double stepped up. So now they have $1 million basis at the death of the first spouse. So zero capital gains if they turned around and sold it right then and there. Now, if they held on to it longer and there was an increase beyond the $1 million, you know, they may be subject to some gain. I know there's an exclusion for $250 for an individual, $500 for a married couple. But you can see how this can be pretty powerful stuff, and most people don't know about that.
We're on with Brenda Geiger. She is a state and trust attorney. Her website, GeigerLawOffice.net. That's the website, GeigerLawOffice.net. If you have any questions, feel free to go to the website or our helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593.
And if you actually have a chance to get to the website, for the first 20 listeners who request a free copy of your book,
yes,
right? I guess you use the code RADIO1700. And you'll get a copy of that book. And, you know, speaking of which, if someone actually says, you know what, I think it's time that I sit down, draw a line in the sand, I need to go out and do something regarding my family trust. Some of the things that we like about what you do is at the initial consultation, you give a book to your potential client. You also give them an outline on what the fees are. So up front, everybody knows exactly what's going on. You've got a ton of articles that you've written. And a lot of those you can actually download from your website, like tips on choosing the right attorney, 13 tips on, you know, choosing the right guardians for your kids. And it just goes on and on, you know, right down to protecting a special needs child.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so, yeah, if you have an opportunity to visit that website, please do.
You have about, let's see, 8 points here that I think we're going to cover. And this is your ebook here, Brenda Geiger's ebook, GeigerLawOffice.net. You have number one, I think we talked about primary residence in a revocable trust. Number two, what would happen if a parent didn't have an estate plan? And what would happen to assets they own to their children?
So if you have minor children and you don't have a plan in place, if you passed away and didn't nominate somebody to be a guardian, basically what you're doing is you're giving your family the opportunity to fight over who takes custody
of
your
kids. Oh, man, do we see that a lot. People get really funny around money. In fact, a lot of times when you assign a child to be the trustee, I mean, they end up taking on a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. So, you know, if you have minor children, I mean, you have to at least have a guardianship nomination so that the court will know what your preference is and who's taking physical custody. And then if for the assets, if they're not held in trust title and there's no will, even if there is a will, it's going to go through the probate process. And at the end of the probate process, if there's no will, basically it goes by the state statute. So it would be held in a conservative account, and it would be the court would assign somebody to take care of that, probably a family member. But at 18, the kids have full access to that money. So we're talking life insurance, proceeds from your home, you know, brokerage accounts, bank accounts, cars,
everything
that you own, you know, your business, all that stuff. So people don't really think about that too much. You know, a lot of people in their 30s and 40s go, well, I'm still kind of building my wealth, you know, but they overlook the fact that a lot of them have a lot of life insurance, you know, sometimes 500, a million or more. And, you know, I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. And I could not even imagine either one of them having access to over $1 million when they reach the age of 18. You know, you're basically asking your kids to become unproductive citizens or even worse, you know, to get involved in some things that we might not want them to be involved in.
Well, you know, regarding real estate, if you have been fortunate enough to acquire some residential property that you rent out, you know, the big thing that I see a lot of times is the liability that they may bring on. Is there anything that we can do ahead of time that could protect us from situations that might arise?
Yeah, the highest and best thing to do is to have each property in its own LLC. That way, if something happens to one real estate rental, it's not going to take down the others, and it's not going to pierce through to your personal assets. So if you have assets outside of that real estate, you don't want somebody suing you personally in your name. You'd rather have them sue your LLC and be limited by what's in the LLC for their redress on that. You can put multiple properties in one LLC. You just have to be aware that you're putting at risk those multiple properties, because if something happens on one property and it goes beyond the value of that property, then you're exposing the other assets inside the LLC.
Really? Interesting. Okay.
But then you also want to make sure that you have your membership interests in the LLC assigned to your trust, because that's what's going to govern and control if something happens to you and you pass away.
Well, that was a really important point, putting each rental property in its separate trust or separate series of your LLC.
Separate LLCs, yeah.
A separate LLC is a great way to protect from making the jump from one property to the other.
Yeah. There is a thing called a series LLC. We do not have them in California, but there are many other states that do adopt that, Delaware being one of them.
That's what I have, the Delaware LLC.
But if you have real estate in California, the state franchise tax board here is unrelenting, and they will come after you for each of the series. So you have to be very careful about being aware that that's something that they can do. Doesn't necessarily mean they will find out, but when they do find out, they could come after you.
Mm-hmm. No.
We've got your branch office, right? So with that, you cover quite an area. What area is would you say your expertise would be? I mean, you go over durable powers of attorney, advanced health care directives, I guess HIPAA, estate administration, trust administration, probate, business success. I mean, is this something that you cover all these areas?
Yeah, my two main practice areas are business planning and estate planning. So estate planning encompasses quite a bit. So, all the incapacity documents, doing trusts, revocable or irrevocable. So basically, yeah, those two main lines of business, yeah.
I have one quick question for you. Some of the guidelines have loosened on lending. You used to be able to do only 1 to 4 properties. Now we can do up to 19 income properties, which is a great thing. But I have a couple clients that have, far more than 10 properties. So if they did a separate LLC on every property, it could be pretty expensive.
There is the setup cost to set up the LLC.
It's like $800 a year just for
that. And then, you've got your $800 state franchise tax board fee.
Okay. Because if you had 20 properties and you're paying that fee for all 20, I guess if the assets are worth it, it might be worth the protection than commingling.
Yeah, it really depends. If you've got a really high net worth client, they're probably going to be less worried about paying that and more concerned about the liability protection. And in that case, if they really wanted to just set up one LLC in Delaware as a series and just pay this, if the properties are in California, just pay that annual $800 state franchise tax board fee on each property, then it's probably not that big of a deal. And the reason I say that is because Delaware has stronger laws when it comes to LLCs and piercing them than California does.
So. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the estate and wealth advisor Brenda Geiger with the Geiger Law Office and Miles Hubers, mortgage loan professional. And one of the things we've covered is the fact that a lot of people will take their property out of a trust in order to refinance and not necessarily put it back in. And we've covered a lot of different areas of ways to protect yourself. So when we come back, we're going to talk more about the tips for choosing the right guardians for your kids and get into some more trust stuff.
Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM is the Real Estate Radio Hour.
With David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. In studio with us today, loan officer extraordinaire Miles Hubers. How you doing, Miles? Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Great. Thanks.
During the break, you just mentioned an eighth rate drop?
Yeah. Midday rate improvement. So the rates went down an eighth today. So that's good news for the bond market.
That's great. Very good news.
Sometimes it goes the other way. Today,
we need
that
to heat the real estate market up, right?
Yeah.
Also with us, Brenda Geiger. Her website, GeigerLawOffice.net. That's the website, GeigerLawOffice.net. She's been telling us everything we want to know, and perhaps a little bit that we don't, about trusts and LLCs. And we're going to continue going through just a few more topics about that.
Yeah, I guess you'd mentioned you have top 25 estate planning mistakes people make and how to avoid them, like right on your website.
Yes.
And it's also part in a chapter in your book, is that right?
Yeah, I actually made it a chapter in my book too.
So, you know, if you already have a trust, are there any issues I should be on alert for regarding my real estate that is owned by the trust? I mean,
you probably want to notify title just that you're adding your trust, so that, you know, if there's ever a title dispute, that you that it would pay to the trust instead of just you individually, because they're going to look to who the actual owner is.
Interesting. So even if you have a trust and it's recorded downtown, when the title goes to pay out, they pay out to the trust?
Yes. Whoever the recorded
owner is.
Owner is, yeah.
Okay. All right. So anything else we should be concerned about avoiding?
Well, as far as real estate's concerned, for your primary residence, you may want to also update your insurance carrier on your house too. So if you ever had a flood or a fire and they have to pay out on it, on that claim, you know, let them know that the house is in trust title.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that's good advice. Again, that's Brenda Geiger, her website, GeigerLawOffice.net. Miles. Wow. I have this written down here. I don't know if I can say this on the air. No doc. Is that a dirty word?
No, stated income is the dirty word.
Uh-huh.
No, we have some new products out there that are Make Sense Lending, and it's kind of loosened with the prices going up and things. We have three new programs. If you want me to, I'll highlight those. My favorite new program is we have a substantial net worth program. So if your net worth is worth more than your loan, you can get a loan. So let's say you're looking for a $400,000 loan, but you have $800,000 in your trust or your 401k. Then you can get a home loan as long as you have a 720 FICO.
That's it?
And you also need to have 30% equity.
So 70% loan to value.
Yep, 30% equity all the way up to $3.5 million.
Okay. Or 30% down. Can you use this on a purchase?
Yes, purchase also. Yep. So that's one new program, and that makes sense because a lot of people want tax deductions, because if you're borrowing money today at 3.5%, that could be as low as, you know, 1.7% after taxes. Well, that's cheap money. So she referenced some books. I love some books. One's called Stop Sitting on Your Assets, where if you can borrow money at, you know, 2% or less after taxes, you could become your own bank and maybe get a higher rate of return and diversify, you know, your portfolio. So the substantial net worth program.
Let's hit that one more time. Let me make sure I'm clear. No tax returns, no W-2s. I do a credit check and bank statements.
720 FICO score.
And 30% equity.
30% down with 30% equity.
Yep.
And you've got a loan. Can you do that for non-owner-occupied properties?
No.
Okay, so this is just primary.
Primary, yes.
So let's say you refinance a primary,
mm-hmm,
and then turn around and purchase one as a primary. Is that allowed?
Yeah, as long as it's your primary residence.
So you're going to move from the primary residence you refinanced on this program and buy something else. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I just had an example of a client that had, I think, $3 million in the stock market. He didn't want to liquidate and pay taxes. Right. So he only wanted $1 million loan because that was tax deductible. So, you know, he was easily, you know, able to get a loan with 30% down as long as he had the 720 FICO. So that's a great new program.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That is fairly new, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. A couple other ones. We have one that goes off basically your bank statements versus your tax returns. So they look at 1 year's bank statements, and that's a very popular new program. So they'll give you 100% credit of what you deposited the last 12 months. So they kind of look at your bank statements like your P&L, your profit and loss statement, if you will. So let's say you buy and sell real estate and you deposit $1 million and you only took $300,000 out. You can go off bank statements versus tax returns. And that's called a 12-month bank statement program.
Wow.
And that's a great one too.
What kind of FICO score is required for that?
720.
720 is a magic number.
30% down.
I guess the question I'm curious about is how competitive are these rates? I mean, not to say that you're going to be able to go out and get a loan a different way, because if you had the income substantiated on your returns, you're probably going to get a much better rate, because this is maybe a little riskier for the bank, so they want to charge a little bit more for that?
You know, it depends what you define as risky. You know, a lot of times with FHA now, there's only 3.5% down and you can have a 580 FICO. So
sounds risky.
That sounds riskier than someone who has 30% down with a 720 FICO and ample cash reserves. So the rates are really good. They're competitive. They range between 2.75 and 4. And we only have a 3, 5, and 7 year fix, though. We don't have a 30-year fix because we can't sell these to the secondary market, to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. We, individual investors have to hold these loans as a portfolio product. So some people, you know, the portfolio, they might not want to hold those more than 7 years. So 7 years on these types of no documentation loans is the longest they'll go as far as term.
And what if you have a married couple? How do you assess their FICO score?
Are they happily married? I'm just kidding, just because you're a trust attorney.
You have to ask. You
know, they take the median FICO, or even one person could go on, the other person off.
Okay.
And then re-record it in your trust. But don't forget, right, to re-record
exactly.
it, which most of my clients do, by the way. They go off trust to refi, and they forget to go back and re-record it to the trust.
Pretty common mistake. I'm
very common because they think the transaction's over because it really was as far as escrow and the bank was concerned, but they have to make sure they re-record it through escrow.
Yeah, I bring this up in my newsletter quite frequently, at least once or twice a year, just to remind clients because, you know, once they leave my office, you know, I have a client care program, so I see a lot of them on an annual basis. But the ones that I don't, I'm so concerned that they might do this and not get it back into the trust.
Yeah, I remember you were telling me, I think you were working with a client recently that had their property out of the trust for 7 years.
Yeah. I had a client that came in to do a restatement, which is common to do if your trust is more than 5 years old. The tax laws change, things happen in your life. You know, as we grow as an industry, changes happen and we do things better. So, you know, it's always something to revisit. But this particular client, 7 years prior, he had refied, came into my office. I pulled title, and it wasn't in the trust.
So a trust is like an account that you set up, and if you don't put things in that trust, it's going to be empty when you need it.
Yeah, it's kind of like a car without gas.
Yeah, so if you refinance or something to this effect and you take the property out, you don't put it back in, when you need it, it's just that shell. It's that car without gas. And there's so many other things that you have to be aware of that could be changing, like the tax laws, like marriages, like people getting married, not, you know, getting divorced. These things are serious flags that need, you know, you need to go in and talk about this, your reevaluation.
Yeah, you know, one of the recent changes we had was the estate tax exemption went to $5.25 million per person. So what that means is during your lifetime and also at death, you can give up to that amount, you know, in combination. So if you gave away $2 million during life, you'd only have $3.25 left at death to give away. But that's what the current law is. When the new administration comes into power, we don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see. But right now we have a pretty high threshold for that. So a married couple can give away $10.5 million.
We're on with Brenda Geiger. She is a trust and estate attorney, GeigerLawOffice.net, as well as Miles Hubers, discussing his no-doc loan options. She said there was three. We talked about two, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the third ahead
Perfect.
Of us when we come back. So happy it's Thursday. Welcome, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. In studio with us today, Brenda Geiger, trust and estate attorney with GeigerLawOffice.net. Also, loan officer extraordinaire Miles Hubers walking us through a couple of his low documentation loan programs.
Some might say out-of-the-box lending.
And supervising all of this going down, we have Kathleen Valbuena supervising everything that's happening here in the studio. Miles, we talked about two low documentation loans, and you said you had three. Let's briefly touch on the other two just so we make sure we're clear on those and hit the third one.
Okay. Well, we talked about the substantial asset product, that if you have no more net worth than your loan amount, then you can get a loan, as long as you have 30% equity and a 720 FICO.
30% equity, 720 FICO.
Yes. So that's the substantial asset program we talked about. We also talked about the bank statement product, that instead of using tax returns, you go off 12 months bank statements. So you look at you get 100% credit for your deposits. So no tax returns required. The third one that you just brought up is we have a program now, instead of providing 2 years tax returns, you only have to have 1 year's tax returns. So let's say you had a really bad year in 2011, but you made a lot more in 2012. We can use just 1 year's tax returns.
So it sounds like you've got some ways around the traditional, I need 2 years' worth of tax returns that every other lender is out there asking for. If for some reason last 2 years' worth of tax returns are not very exciting, or in the last case, if one of your last 2 years where the tax returns are not very exciting, you've got some ways around the traditional, let's say, banking requirements.
Yes, outside the guidelines of the government.
Outside the guidelines of the government.
These are portfolio loans that we hold. Basically, they all come down to if you have a 720 FICO and you have 30% equity, there's a good chance you're going to get a loan.
Really?
Yeah.
With you?
With us.
With you. So Miles Hubers, his phone number, 858-735-4323. That's the number, 858-735-4323. If you're in a position where your tax returns don't show the kind of income you really have, let's say you've got a really creative CPA and he's writing everything off, usually the CPAs and the loan officers are kind of battling because the CPA wants to make your tax returns look really bad because you don't pay taxes. But you can't get a loan if your tax returns look really bad. I see quite a struggle going on there. Sounds like you found a way around it there, Miles. One more time, Miles Hubers, 858-735-4323, has three different solution products for tax returns that are less than spectacular and getting you a loan.
Yeah, and you mentioned that if somebody was on the fence and they thought, well, geez, you know, I don't know if I have a 720 FICO score, but I do know what my assets are, that you guys would talk to them for free and run that whole process and see if they do qualify.
Yeah, absolutely. They can call for a free consultation, and we'd probably know within, you know, 3 or 4 minutes if they would qualify for the program.
Seems pretty straightforward, actually.
It's pretty simple.
Pretty simple. You talked earlier in the show about the HARP program,
mm-hmm,
and 200% upside down. Run us through that one more time, because I think that's a really crucial thing everybody should hear again.
If you lose track of this, I have a website called IcanKeepMyHome.com. Okay?
Okay.
So IcanKeepMyHome.com. The government basically, HARP means Home Affordability Refinance Program. So you could be up to 200% upside down in refi if you're current on your payment. And that's eligible for your primary residence and for your income properties.
How long do you have to be current on your payment?
You could have missed one payment in the last 12 months.
Wow.
That's one 30-day payment.
One late payment.
Late payment. And is there a FICO score requirement on that?
No, just one late payment. They do look at your FICO, and if there were all kinds of other issues, it could be a deterrent.
And no income requirement verification there?
They don't look for tax returns. They look for your gross income, not your net.
Is the basic idea that we already have the loan, we're stuck with this person, you know? Because it has to be Fannie or Freddie loan, right?
Yeah, it's got to be Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, which are most of those loans are under 695. So if your loan's over 695, probably a pretty good chance your house is not HARP eligible for Fannie Freddie. HARP 3.0, you asked me about that last time I was on the show. That's supposed to be coming out for people that have loans that are not Fannie Freddie.
Right.
And it's still in Congress, and we're hoping that comes out for the people that have $1.3 million homes.
Well, it could be a $1.3 million home, but the loan amount could be underneath that threshold. Is that right?
Very true.
Yeah, so the value could be
$1 million. It's based on the loan amount, not the property.
And the loan amount could be lower.
Right. But I think it's important to know most people don't know that their income properties are eligible. And, you know, it kind of makes sense to stimulate the economy, too, because if someone goes from 6.5 to 3.5, they'll take that savings and they usually spend. And that's how we, you know, spend creates jobs, people buy things, and that's how we come out of recession. And it's been helping.
It has been helping. I mean, a lot of people are out there, the buyers especially, are complaining about the fact there's no inventory. And the fact there's no inventory could be because these programs that you're speaking of right now are actually taking effect and helping us come out of this recession.
I had a client the other day that I think he was paying 7.25. He refinanced to 3.25. So his house was $800 negative as a rental. Now it breaks even.
Wow.
So since it breaks even, even though he's upside down, there's no equity, he's going to hang on to it. And,
right.
You know, one day the equity will be back and he won't ruin his credit and he won't have a short sale and he won't have a foreclosure.
Well, I'm sure the neighbors are happy about that because no one wants someone on their street to give their property away, and then the values are looked upon differently and the refinance could be difficult because of the appraisals. I mean, right now a lot of agents out there are reinventing themselves because all cash offers, offers without appraisal contingencies, shortening up of the timeframes associated with inspecting the properties are all too common. In fact, we're seeing right now that people are making the sale of their house contingent upon finding suitable housing because selling the property has become less of a concern and finding the right one has become the big issue.
Yeah, we certainly are seeing that pop up. A strategy that we've employed in the past, or at least heard employed, is the I guess it would be the using of a reverse mortgage to purchase a home. You talked about that a little bit in the break.
Yeah, well, I think a reverse mortgage is if you're over 62 years old. The government ensures that you'll never, as long as you occupy that property, you'll never have a mortgage payment. So you could pull out up to 60% of your equity or get a monthly installment, and you'll never have a mortgage payment on that property.
Well, I'll give you an example of how this can work. I mean, I'm a fan of this program because I have a client that came to me with around $300,000, and we were looking in that $300,000 range. There's really beat up properties out there. You know, this is going to be the home he wants to spend the rest of his life in. He wants no mortgage payment. And we took a look at the reverse purchase, and with 40% down, the loan limit is what, $625 on that?
It's different per zip code.
Okay. And we were able to go up to $625,000 with that $300,000 and acquire a property and still accomplish the no payment program. And he got a single level ranch style home with a 3-car garage, granite countertops. He didn't have to do any remodeling on it. It's a fantastic property. And it's really all because of that program. And a lot of people aren't aware that if you're over 62 and you have 40% down on a home, you can get a loan up to $625,000 depending on the zip code.
Well, just to kind of
no mortgage
be specific on that, it all depends on your age, on your life expectancy. And so you have to be 60.
Right, the higher, the less you have to put down, right? The older
yes,
you are.
Yes, because the life expectancy, I think, for a male is something like 83 and a female is longer. So the older you are, the more money you could get back as far as monthly cash flow. Some people are living on Social Security and they get $2,000 a month and their bills are $2,000 a month. So they're barely living, but they're equity rich but cash poor. So they
and they don't want to sell their house or move because then they have no place to live,
exactly.
And the cost of rent or mortgage payment may be more than what they're paying now.
So on the refinance side of it, they might take a monthly installment. Let's say they're making a $3,000 payment per month. They might get $3,000 a month. So that's a $6,000 a month swing in lifestyle.
That's
well, they
big difference.
Recently rewrote this program, right? It used to be a whole different program. Now, when you purchase a property, that purchase price is only the amount that the lender has a stake in. Anything above that. So if you buy a house for $600,000, if you pass away, that $600,000 is what the bank has a stake in because of the no mortgage payment. Anything above that, so you buy a house for $600,000, you live in it for 20 years, and it goes up to $1 million, that $400,000 difference, I believe, can still be passed on to your heirs.
Well, you obviously, the interest rate, you know, the depends if you lock in. If you lock in at 3.25 or something, you're losing whatever that interest rate is if you're going to give that to your siblings or whoever you're going to give that
right,
to.
Right. It's like every month a little bit of it chips away, right? It's
yeah.
Like,
so let's say your interest payment is $20,000 a year. You're losing $20,000 a year in equity, except for the house could be appreciating more than the rate that you're taking out in interest rate. So let's say you buy the house for $600,000 and you pass away 10 years from now and the house is worth $1 million. You may have more equity than when you started if you bought it right. So some of the people are concerned to do a reverse mortgage too because they want to leave as much money as they can to their children. And one way around that is they buy life insurance. So I have a client that was free and clear, and so they took $600,000 out. Well, they don't have a mortgage on that $600,000. Well, with some of that money, they bought a life insurance policy, so actually their siblings will inherit more. They'll get whatever equity is left in the house plus the insurance. So they live better and could enjoy life more, and whoever they want to inherit their estate could inherit more if it's done right.
Sounds like a really good strategy.
I like it. I mean, I like the fact that we can go to you when it comes to that out-of-the-box kind of lending and really have a discussion about what the future plans could be and come up with a solution that would work really well.
We're on with Miles Hubers, mortgage banker extraordinaire, has at least 3, maybe even 4 programs for those of you out there looking to purchase or refinance, and your tax returns don't necessarily support the kind of loan you're looking to get. His phone number directly, 858-735-4323. One more time, 858-735-4323. Also on the show, Brenda Geiger, her website, geigerlawoffice.net. We talked about her trust and estate symposium coming up here on May 30th. You can go to her website or call the office, right? 760 760-448-2220. One more time, 760-448-2220. Guys, thanks all for joining us. Talk to y'all next week.
Are you getting the runaround from your bank about your loan modification? Hi, Timmy Two Sides here. If you want help with your loan mod, call my attorney, Andrew Moyer. Andrew is experienced, honest, and he'll shoot you straight about your chances. Plus, you won't pay a